Support for WPR comes from Viterbo University, offering online bachelor completion programs, including business, education, nursing, and more. Information is available at viterbo.edu/completion.
Support for WPR comes from Becca Kate's Kitchen, Kids and Home in downtown Baraboo, offering gourmet cookware, specialty gadgets, and bridal registry. More at BEKAHKates.com.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, it's always fun to talk about birds, especially with our guest for today, Bill Volker, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. He worked at Horicon Marsh for more than 27 years, written books, has led many bird watching tours, and we're going to talk with him about travel and birds, and of course, we'll talk about Wisconsin birds as well as we move along today, and he'll be with us for our entire show. So it's going to be great to have him here for an extended period of time. So as we talk with Bill, I hope you'll join in. Tell us which birds are brightening your day these days. Maybe you've had an experience with birds that you want to share with us. Maybe you can talk about a recent travel experience that you might have had with birds. Lots to talk about, and the number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email or a photo to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bill Volker, good to have you back.
Hi, Larry. Pleasure to be here, as always.
So here we are. Happy New Year, by the way.
And then to you as well.
Any resolutions relating to birding?
Yeah, keep traveling. You know, before we begin, I should preface this by saying that actually your producer, Clara, had invited me to be here about a month ago, and I had to change the date because while we're talking about birding travel, I was traveling.
Yeah, so, and a couple of exciting places.
Yeah, we were just in Cuba and Jamaica for some of the special birds there. But, yeah, you know, we're getting into starting the new year, and this is, of course, that time, as you said, for reflection. And I think we both look back at the past year, what were some of the highlights and special experiences we had, and also planning for the coming year. And for myself, of course, my highlights are always the travel. And I think for everyone, you know, a vacation is always just something special in a year. And when I think about traveling, I like to think about, say, if you're gone for a week or 2 weeks, think about any week or 2 weeks during a year, just your routine. It comes, it goes, you do more or less the same routine. And when you look back at the year, there's nothing really outstanding. But when you go on a two-week vacation, my gosh, you know, you're on even just the second day, and it seems like so much has already happened. It's such an experience. And it really underscores a year. It really punctuates that as a special experience out of a whole year. And to me, I think that's always been the value of it. Nothing like good travel.
Yeah, well, I would agree with that. How many different kinds of birds, species of birds, are there in the world?
The number now is at 11,000, and I think the exact count with the last revisions is 11,007. And that number has been growing, and it's not because we are discovering new birds that have never been seen before. And I really think that at this point, with so many bird watchers and people who've been scouring all the different remote areas of the planet, we've not only seen and identified probably every bird out there, I imagine we've even photographed all of them. And now we're even working on recording the voices of every bird there. The reason the numbers are changing is because we're still defining and trying to agree on what do we mean by a species. Okay. And you know, if somebody asks me, so how many kinds of birds are there? I think what you are looking at is you assume that's going to be a black and white world. Give me the exact number. And I would describe that in nature, there's a lot of shades of gray. There's a lot of birds that, well, the difference between, say, little variation or a lot, where will you draw the line between, say, a subspecies in a population or in a, decide to reclassify it as a species? Not everybody agrees where that line should be drawn, and we're still trying to define that. And that's why the number's gone up. I can say this much. I just uploaded the most recent world list of birds. I went through on my computer, and I gained 22 birds without even leaving my computer. The problem, though, and this is why I don't put the big emphasis on just numbers and life lists, though I do certainly keep track, is that there was no new experience for me. I didn't see anything new. It's just a recount of what I've already seen. But I guess for me, it's also another measure. Yeah. So when I travel, I always think of what was the unique places I went to. I think of all the pictures I took. And certainly, you know, another measure is how many kinds of birds did I see and what were some of the special ones.
Yeah. And you, your list, is, your life list is over, what, 4,000?
4,460 as of latest count.
So better than a third of all the birds.
Yeah. My goal would be to see half the birds in the world, but... You know, it's always time and money.
Well, yeah, you need to win the lottery.
And there are some people who, first of all, I've got larger financial budgets than me, and those are much more competitive that really.
Yeah.
And some people are just about the numbers. They really get out there. But I'm looking for as much that quantity of birds as well as the quality of the experience. And yeah. We always take time to study them, photograph them, and see some of the other sites in these countries as well.
Well, Linda in Racine has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I was visiting Lincoln Woods Park in Rhode Island, and I was fortunate on my walk to come across a junior pileated woodpecker eating some decayed wood and insects, and his mother was up above in a tree.
Oh, so just out of the nest. Oh, there's a wonderful sight. Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
Just amazing. It was really cool. I stood there and was able to just watch the baby on the ground eating from the decomposed tree while the mom sat up higher. And I was afraid, like, is it going to try and fly at me? But all was calm, and it was a cool experience.
Then that is a big woodpecker, isn't it?
Oh, it's
huge.
Yeah, it's a great experience. I was in Peninsula State Park with daughter Emily, and we came on a pileated pair with their young, and the young were down on the ground.
And it's always interesting to see young ones that are just out. They don't have quite that full plumage and color yet, and they're also still learning.
Yes.
So to see them try to pick up the tricks there of how to secure that food. And as she mentioned, the bird on the ground, a big woodpecker like that will not only chisel deep into the heart of a tree to get at the large ant galleries and colonies that are there, but also rotten logs on the ground. They will hammer on those because there's always the chance of some good food there.
And Linda, I bet you had the same experience I had in that I was able to take some pretty good photos of both the adults and the young, because the adults wouldn't fly off. They stayed right there because the young were on the ground. Was that your experience?
Well, in my case, I had my dog Matilda with me.
Oh.
And I was trying to make a video, and I didn't have a good grip on my phone with my dog, so it was very blurry. And the adult was very high up in a very bare tree. So they were pretty far distance apart from each other height-wise. And the video is unfortunately blurry, but hey, I had the memory.
You've got the memory of it and that vision in your head, whether you captured it on video or not.
Yeah.
And that's always a nice thing when you get a bird that's engaged, feeding busily, that they're not on alert and ready to fly away, or a young one like this that's still a little bit shy that way and maybe, you know, not quite as cautious as you should be. You can approach them a bit and get some pictures and enjoy an extended view rather than a quick flash of something and he's gone.
Yeah, that was my experience, I really, really enjoyed it. And then we happened on them a couple of other times in the course of our stay there. So it was really a lot of fun. Linda, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Maybe you've got an experience to share, a question to ask, a relationship to birds. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email and or photo to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Is there anywhere in the world where there aren't any birds?
About the only place would be the interior of Antarctica. Of course, the penguins and some of the other seabirds are along the coast because they're feeding out on the open water. But that's the only place. I mean, you can go out way in the middle of the ocean and you're going to see albatrosses, shearwaters, birds feeding in incredibly remote areas. There was an interesting result of a albatross that was tagged with GPS in Australia, and they said within 8 days the thing was over in South America, covered across the entire south of the Pacific. So birds will wander huge areas. Certainly birds migrate annually across long distances, and some of these seabirds, unless they're actually nesting, they're just wandering out there and picking up food. So you can go almost anywhere. And that's a nice thing about birding, is that there's hardly any place on the planet that you can't go and see birds. And to me, I think everybody enjoys not only just a good vacation, but to go to natural areas is always great to see some beautiful landscapes, mountains, deserts. Those are always, I think, just rewarding sights, those kinds of landscapes. But to look a little deeper into that landscape, to me, birds are a window to the natural world. It's something to focus on. It takes you to those places, and it tells me something about that environment. And on top of that, it gives me something to pursue. So, you know, birds, just by their own nature, they're relatively easy to see. Many of the species are very colorful and, you know, very attractive. So they're not only easy to find, but they're great to look at. And as we said, they occur almost anywhere. So, you know, you can always go somewhere to see birds and almost everywhere to see something new. And I find that if you follow the birds, they will take you to some of those beautiful places on Earth, too.
They will indeed. Bill Volkert, our guest. Bill, we can travel all over the world here today on the show. Let's start, though, in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? And what are we, or where can see winter birds in Wisconsin? Where are the best places?
Well, for winter birds, along the Lake Michigan shore, there is open water, so there are birds out there. In fact, there's been a number of reports of snowy owls that are showing up along Lake Michigan shore. They're hunting out there. Some of them will take a few of the ducks that are unwary and anything else they can find, so they're coming down from the Arctic. Certainly the songbirds, we not only have the year-round birds like our chickadees, cardinals, nuthatches, and woodpeckers that remain, but we're getting northern birds coming down. A few of the crossbills are showing up. Finches, the northern finches, they tend to be irregular in their migration because that has a lot to do with whether there's a good food crop in Canada or not. So it's not the cold, but, you know, and it's like anything that fruits, you got good years and bad years. So we may get this fallout or invasion of birds that come down here. And it looks like there's pretty good food in Canada this year. So some of the finches, like the red poles and purple finches, seem to be showing up in small numbers this year. Certainly the North Woods, great spot. And birds right now are looking wherever there's food and there's good shelter. So if your local park, nature center, you'll be able to find birds in lots of areas. And I know that people are traveling around a little bit for some of the concentrations of flocks, say out in Green Bay, along Lake Michigan. Here in the Madison area, there's open water on some of the lakes yet. A lot of it's frozen over, but you'll harbor some water birds in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was out for my morning jog at around 6 o'clock or so, and along Lake Monona, and I was thinking about today's show actually, because I couldn't see them because it was dark. It was pretty dark yet, but I could certainly hear the geese. I think there was a swan or more than one.
Mm-hmm.
And some ducks, for sure, probably mallards, but there may have been others. But they were all talking at the same time, and it was just this wonderful noise, wonderful conversations that they were all having at that early morning hour. And I wondered, what gets them talking like that?
Well, some of it is just communication. So among geese, you've got a large flock out there. But the young will stay with the adults throughout that first year. So they're keeping each other together. And they do recognize voice differences. In the same way for us, I mean, anybody you hear from a foreign language all sounds like chatter, but you recognize your friends and family on the telephone by their voice. So it seems to be that they can recognize that. That keeps them together. They also are sort of contentment calls, let everyone know it's okay. If there is danger, they go on to alert a little bit, you know, watch it, somebody's approaching. And, of course, then that might escalate to a flight call if things get a little dangerous for them. So it's a way to just stay in contact with everyone, keep a family together for one, and let everybody else know that, you know, it's all fine right now.
Tell you that, I can tell you one thing, it was really a lot of fun to listen to.
Well, and winter is such a vacant time, both the sight of an open landscape, no leaves, and, you know, and then also very quiet out there. So, yeah, it really helps to bring a little bit of music to the day.
Brightened it up for me anyway. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator. We're talking birds and zeroing in a little on travel, but taking your questions and comments as well as we move along, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking birds and birding today with our guest, Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist. It's great to have him with us today. And again, you can join in with your own comments here. We've talked a little about travel, and we'll get into that more as we move along today. But any question relating to birds, we'd love to hear from you. And Nick in Green Bay has something for us. Nick, hello.
Hi. I just got a question for you. We just bought a house, and I'm kind of weird. I like the gray squirrels, so I put up a gray squirrel feeder. And the offset of that is I got flying squirrels, which is really cool. How do I encourage them to stay around my feeder? I keep putting corn up, and they're really awesome. My daughter got to pet one, and they're super friendly.
As far as sticking around, yeah, if you just have the food for them, they'll certainly take advantage of it, especially the big sunflower seeds. They are nocturnal, so yeah, you have to have a little bit of a light on to watch them coming to the feeders. They're really common in forested areas. So as long as you've got the trees around you, I think you're going to have the flying squirrels around, and you can lure them in a little bit by keeping your bird feeder available for them.
Yeah, shouldn't be a problem, Nick. Thank you for calling. Sally in Ferryville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sally.
Hello, Larry. My question is, just lately, like in the last 10 days, I've seen a pair of bluebirds kind of landing on the bluebird nest or the box. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious about that. It seems like they should be somewhere else.
Yeah.
Good question. Bluebirds, they're certainly not going to nest now, but they may use that as an evening roost site, a place to shelter. So they may take advantage of the box that way. But we actually will pick up bluebirds and even robins on Christmas bird counts. I conducted a count just a week ago, and I did hear one robin late in the day, and I know people had reported bluebirds. So the vast majority of those birds do migrate out of Wisconsin, but when we get the Christmas bird count, we get bird watchers all over the state looking very closely, we will find that a few remain. And so there's a little bit of a trade-off there as birds fatten up in fall time. Do they use all that energy and fly down towards, say, Missouri, Texas to escape Wisconsin winter, or do they store that fat and just try to get through? And right now they're shifting over a lot to berries, can be a food for them. So as long as that crop remains, they can stick around. So keep in mind, the big thing is it isn't so much cold weather, it's food. And as long as there's food out there, birds are pretty well insulated and well adapted to it. And some of them decide to stick around. We say the same thing with great blue heron. Probably 98% of them migrate out of the state. But if there's a little open water somewhere and there's access to food, if the fish are there, one or two of them may decide to stick around. And again, Christmas bird counts, they may show up in small numbers. And it's always a surprise for a bird like that to think that some of them are going to decide to try to make it through a Wisconsin winter.
Yeah, absolutely. Sally, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Chris in Manitowoc has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We just moved into our home in Manitowoc, and it's close to downtown, so it's pretty urban. And I put feeders outside our dining room window, and it's been about 4 weeks, and nobody has come. to feed. And I don't know why. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Well, I don't think you're doing anything necessarily wrong. It takes a little while for birds to find the food. And we also have to have some shelter nearby. So think about your landscaping plans for springtime, putting in some conifers, some shrubs, a place to shelter for themselves. That will make it feel a little bit more secure as well. And we even find that for bird feeders, those birds that visit feeders, the vast majority of their food is still gathered in the wild. It's just a matter of convenience. So you'll notice they sometimes come and go. And if you talk to enough people who have bird feeders, some will tell you that they're not seeing much. Others say they can hardly keep up. So it's a little bit of a different scene sometimes. And it may have a lot to do with your neighborhood in terms of the kind of habitat that you have, the habits of the birds in the neighborhood, whether they're attracted to that feeder. And sometimes from year to year also, you'll see that the activity comes and goes.
Yeah, I was thinking about one of the feeders I have is between the sidewalk and the street out front, and mm-hmm. there's not really a shrub there, and I don't get the mm-hmm. near the activity I get in the backyard.
Yep. Yeah, and we just came back 2 weeks ago from our most recent trip, and I had to start all over with the feeders, and it took the birds about 3 days before they even started showing up. And once the word got around among the flock, they were coming pretty regularly now. But yeah, it took a little while for them.
Chris, thank you for
calling. Just keep the feeders full and just wait.
Yeah, they'll be there. Mary in Lebanon, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, on the 20th, I have a lot of habitat here for wildlife. Mm-hmm. And my husband planted a kind of crab apple that has berries and fruit in the fall and winter.
Mm-hmm.
And on the 22nd of December, I happened to look out the window, and this tree was just alive with robins. I have never seen so many robins. I'm lucky if I get a pair or two here in the summer. And so that was really interesting. And then I noticed it was earlier, probably in November, I had a rusty blackbird. Now, my daughter gave me Cornell membership, so then I used Merlin, and that's how I heard that sound. And then I did spot it, and then I had a female towhee, too.
Oh, good for you. Good birds.
Yeah, and the only time I know that we had seen a male towhee around here once, but mm-hmm. we went to the Ashland Bird Festival, and that's where we learned about towhees and things and so on. The other thing I noticed is there are not many tree swallows anymore here. And they used to fight over the houses.
Yeah, the swallow numbers have declined. Barn swallow, tree swallow. Yeah, we're not seeing as many as we used to. We do have a working group in Wisconsin on the aerial insectivores, those birds that catch their insects out of the air, the swifts, the swallows, the nighthawks, and birds like that. And yeah, we've noticed a decline in them. Barn swallow, some of it is related to nesting space because they did use the old barns, and as people have gone to the steel buildings, they're closed in and just don't have that access. Or they not only came through the old windows and open doors, but also under the eaves. Well, yeah. These new buildings don't have that kind of nest space available. So that's one thing. And we also think it's related to both the lack of insects. I mean, literally do the windshield survey, drive around in summer and see what you're not hitting like we used to. And these are birds that migrate all the way to Central and even down to South America. And so with that, we don't even know if there's, say, contaminants in food or pesticides that may be restricted here or used somewhere else. We don't know what neonicotinoids are doing to birds as a more newer chemical. So it's a combination of things. There's not one single impact, but we do notice that all of this is adding up to have an impact on the birds, and we're not seeing the numbers we used to.
Yeah,
it's unfortunate.
The crab apple tree sounds like fun, though.
That's a good tree. Now, that's a big fruit, so a bluebird, that might be quite a hefty thing for them to choke down. But robins and cedar waxwings just love them. And if those fruits, if they're really abundant in fruiting, they'll last well into the winter. It'll take a long time for the birds to pick those. So that can be quite the attractive tree. So, yeah, if you're looking for both a nice ornamental tree as well as something to bring the birds in, that works very well.
And Mary also mentioned the Ashland Bird Festival. Do you know that festival?
Yes, there are bird festivals that occur throughout Wisconsin. Most of them are in springtime during the migration when the birds are on the move. So there should be something of an event near almost anybody. I know I've been at bird festivals in Manitowish Waters over toward the Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls area. Milwaukee certainly has it. You just look around where there are these nature centers and bird clubs, and they usually have an event open to the public. So maybe for a slow winter day, they probably haven't yet posted the dates, but I'm sure they're starting to select them, and that information will come up. And so give it a little time. You can search around for an event for springtime. And it's a great way not only just to be able to enjoy the birds and learn from someone, but go to a place during that time of year when it's really rich, go out with a local expert. And as Mary had mentioned, get that introduction to a bird like a towhee or something that maybe you'd never seen before or perhaps didn't even know existed in Wisconsin. So it's a great way to do that. Get out with an expert during that time of year. And as I said, there's probably one nearby you somewhere.
Mary, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it very much. Lyman in McFarland has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Lyman.
Hi there. About 2 or 3 years ago, we had a late cold spring, and the colors of the male goldfinches and the cardinals just did not seem to develop that summer. You almost had to look twice at the cardinal to decide whether it was a male or a female. And the male goldfinches were sort of this strange cream color instead of their brilliant yellow. And that has persisted here in McFarland to some extent, even up to this year. Do you know anything about that?
No, and I've not observed that among the birds by me. Usually that kind of color has something to do with the nutrition. So in the same way that flamingos, that bright pink, that has to do with their food. And if you keep them in captivity, like the zoos, they have to actually have a special diet because otherwise they'll turn just grayish. So I'm assuming for these birds, it may be a little bit of something related to diet. And I can't imagine what might have changed in the environment for their diet. But interesting observation, and we'll certainly be watching for that. I appreciate you bringing that to our attention.
Yeah, thanks, Lyman. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR.org. RJ emailed us a picture. He spotted this bird in Madison in the spring. Thinks it's a sparrow, but doesn't look like a sparrow to me.
No, it's blackbird.
Yeah,
and he's a little fluffed up, a little ruffled up, and looking at that head and bill, looks like a red-winged blackbird to me. That red on the wing should be the giveaway, but since his feathers are raised up like that, you really can't see that. And oftentimes when I try to get a good look at a bird, it sometimes takes a second or two for the bird to move, to posture a little bit.
Yeah.
Or like when something is flying across the sky in front of you, you have to watch it for a little distance till you get that real cue on it. So this is sometimes a little bit of a trick with the picture because you're getting that one stop of the bird at one very small moment in time. So I think right here we've got red-winged blackbird, and it just turns out that red on the wing is hidden. And by the way, you'll notice that when the birds are off a territory where they have a yellow stripe with the big red panel above it, they oftentimes cover that up. So I've had the question over the years many times, how come some of the red-winged blackbirds have bright red wings and some of them only have a little yellow? Well, that's because they're off territory. So when they come to my feeder, more of the birds will cover that up. Usually one aggressive one will come in and he'll show that color. And what this is among the males, when they're establishing their breeding territories, say when they're scattered out across a marsh, they both sing and puff up their feathers, flare the tail, and they show that bright reddish epaulette. That's both a visual and, of course, the singing auditory signals. That's their claim. This is my area. So it's a bit of an aggressive type of posture. Well, if you're off a territory, you don't come to the feeder with an attitude. So you cover that up. You're just simply feeding. Now you can be among a flock, and it's a little bit more compatible. You don't want to get everybody else on alert. So that's really why we sometimes will see these birds covering that up when they're off territory. And that's, I think, what we're seeing right here.
That's very interesting. Kurt in Wausau, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning.
Hello.
Probably about 8 or 9 years ago, I was driving in the Lac du Flambeau area, in an isolated area, And all of a sudden, I noticed bald eagles. And I, you know, very seldom will we head up north and not see a bald eagle. But I'm talking, there had to be, oh gosh, 18 to 20 of various ages. Some had, most had the white heads, but some did not have their white heads or tails yet. Mm-hmm. And I've often wondered what could, I mean, my first thought is there must have been some deer that passed away or a number of deer or somebody is feeding these things. Or I've never seen them congregate, and I've always been puzzled as to what could have caused that.
And when was that, Kurt? What time of the year?
You know, to tell you the truth, when I say 8 or 9 years ago, it was probably more like 10 or 12, and I really don't recall. It either had to be early spring or maybe even fall, because I don't recall a lot of leaves on the trees.
Yeah, it sounds like it's probably late season, and it all has to do with food. There was something out there, you're right. Deer carcass, it'll attract a few birds, but they're now feeding in close proximity. Over and fighting over that carcass. You said lack the flambeau. There's a lot of water up there.
Yes.
Must have been some pretty good fishing available for them. Of course, there is also the Eagle Days along the Wisconsin River out by Sauk City, Prairie du Sac. The birds concentrate there because, especially in harsh winters, it's some of the only open water below the dam, and that's where they can fish. And so when you get a lot of food in an area, that's where they'll concentrate. So, they're normally quite solitary birds. But you will get this on occasion. All of a sudden, the salad bar is open.
Yeah.
Or in this case, it's the fish fry. So they're all right there. And, there had to be something about some highly concentrated food that was easy pickings.
Thank you, Kurt. Appreciate it. Peggy Sue and Brilliant, on to you now. Hi, Peggy Sue.
Hi. How are you guys today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Hey, thanks for taking it. I usually call about plants, Larry, but today I have some really spectacular things to talk about. First of all, I looked out my window, my west window yesterday while I was drinking coffee and looking out the window, and here are two huge eagles sitting in the tree. They had to be 3 feet tall, just gorgeous. And the other thing is, it's a beautiful time of year. I live 2 miles west of Brilliant, and we have been hearing the great horned owls out there. They're getting ready, I guess, to make babies.
Yes, they're on territory now, and they are hooting to establish that territory and calling their mates. So, the earliest nesting bird in Wisconsin.
Okay, I'll have to keep my pugs in at night then, because they'll probably eat one of them. But my question for you is this. I lived up in northern Wisconsin several years ago, excuse me, and we had this huge black bird up there, and all the natives up there told me they were ravens.
Mm-hmm.
So when I walk outside of my house, they are the first to let all the birds know that I'm out there. They're big mouths. And I don't think they're crows. My boyfriend keeps saying, oh, those are crows. I'm like, no, a crow is not almost 3 feet tall.
Yeah, ravens and crows, from a distance or a quick glance, they may look quite similar. Raven is a larger bird, a little heavier bill. So, and a bigger chest on it, probably one of the best field marks is the shape of the tail. So when you see them flying off, a crow has a squared off tail. So the bottom edge of the tail is straight across, where the raven is described as wedge shape. It comes to a little bit of a point. And of course, call is going to be really the big giveaway, where you get that cawing that we're familiar with for the crow. It's a more of a croaking, raspy call of the raven. And you can hear that across the north woods from quite a distance. Ravens are also considered, among some people, as among the smartest birds in the world. They're very curious. They have a real good vocabulary. Their vocal repertoire is a lot of different sounds. They communicate among each other. And they're also a bird that they've noticed in Alaska that seemed to play. There was an anecdote of ravens actually sliding down a hill on their bellies, that they were like sledding. And there was no other explanation except that they were just having fun. And the fact that a bird has extra time just to have fun, it seems to be kind of a unique exception among birds, that here's a bird that really is a little bit different from others. So, yeah, they seem to be extremely intelligent birds.
And the raven, the call, there's nothing like, I've sat out in the woods in the Shawamigan National Forest in the morning, and it's quiet all around, and then you hear that raven call.
And if you listen to that in Crow, it is absolutely diagnostic.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's the easiest way to distinguish the two.
Peggy Sue, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jay in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jay.
Hi. I mailed you the photograph of that bird, the blackbird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just want to really clarify. I spent three different days watching that bird, and recording its call and using Merlin.
Okay.
And it came back as a house sparrow. And the first time I spotted it, there was a male house sparrow sitting on a pipe. And as soon as the black sparrow flew over to it, they chirped at each other, and the black sparrow flew into the pipe. And I went back the next week, and it was still there. It was on the ground with other sparrows. And to be completely honest with you, red-winged blackbirds are like my favorite bird. So,
okay.
I mean, if it was a red-winged blackbird, I would have known it. So I don't know what that is. You know, I know it's not albino. I've seen, you know, sparrows with like white wings and things like that.
Right.
And I thought it was very unusual.
Well, as you mentioned, partial albinism or complete albino does show up in birds in very small numbers, but there's a number of different species that we'll see that will have that lack of pigment. But the opposite of that, the melanism, is usually something that we don't see in birds where they turn black like that. Something as widespread and common as house sparrow, it's possible there's that mutation. And perhaps that's something unusual that you have.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. Pretty interesting. Jay, thank you for calling back. Appreciate the call. Carrie in Cronenwetter. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Hey, I have a problem with mourning doves. They come and take over my bird feeders, keeping the other birds out. So I tried downsizing the size of my feeders,
mm-hmm.
and that seemed to work in keeping the mourning doves out. But now I don't get my cardinals and blue jays and some of the mid-sized birds. So do you got any suggestions?
Well, if you have multiple feeders, you might be able to spread them out, or, of course, you may just bring in more mourning doves. Yeah, interesting that you would have that many that are dominating the feeder. They tend to feed both on the feeders and on the ground. If you were to try to put a little seed on the ground and put up multiple feeders, maybe we could spread it out a little bit to give some of the other birds opportunity. That's one alternative. It's just a little experimentation. But, you know, you start to put out offerings for foods, and it's open to everyone, and you may end up with mixed results. And I know people who have a hard time trying to keep the squirrels off or house sparrows that may dominate the feeders. So, yeah, you don't always get what you want just by putting out the feeders. But, yeah, I would experiment a little bit. If you try sunflower seeds, that might be a little bit harder for the mourning doves to be taking, a little bit larger seed rather than the cracked corn and millet. That's another alternative. And even the thistle, which is something that on that type of tube feeder, mourning dove wouldn't be able to perch. It's going to attract the finches, not the cardinals. But experiment a little bit with what you're offering and see if that can't lure in some of the other birds that you'd rather have.
Good luck, Harry. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Just along the food line, we got an email from someone who said they make seed cakes with sunflower seed, corn, and mealworms, and they use bacon grease for the, you know, the mixture, mm-hmm. and the birds gobble it up. Woodpeckers, nuthatches, buntings, they guess if they eat it, it must be okay. But what are, your comments on using bacon grease.
The only thing about bacon is you want to make sure it's not too salty. Yeah, the fat, the birds certainly go for it. I mean, suet, take a look at that, whether it's the say prepared suet cakes that's sort of rendered, or whether it's the straight the suet that you would get out of the butcher, the fat, that certainly not a problem for the birds. But when we start using our food, you have to watch a little bit what might be in it, and I would be concerned about salt content. The other thing, of course, peanut butter, I wouldn't do that. That's hard to get down. I mean, you try to eat a peanut butter sandwich and not drink anything, you'll see the problem for birds. And, of course, people who go to the parks, it's very traditional to tear up a little bit of bread for the ducks. It's not easy to digest, and it's really not that healthy. So, yeah, some of the human food, they'll take it, but it may not be of the best diet for them.
Kim had emailed us a picture of a woodpecker at her suet feeder. And
that's great, isn't it? Yeah. Affiliated woodpecker come to suet feeder.
Affiliated.
Yeah, I've seen a number of pictures, and I know a lot of people who are able to attract them. I've not had that luck. You need a little something for a big bird like that to perch and hang on. But yeah, they will take advantage of that suet. Again, this is what we have here is the suet, the fat that's in there, and a lot of birds will take advantage, including this big guy.
Bill Volkert, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Talking birds and birding today with Bill Volkert. Great to have Bill back. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. Appreciate your calls and your emails, and we have lots of both. Darren Appleton wondered if you'd comment, Bill, on the white wagtail that's recently been seen in Door County, far, far away from home. What makes a species wander so far from their normal range? Is it more common than we think? But the odds of finding these wanderers are probably low.
Well, I guess I could answer the first part about the uniqueness of it as to what makes them wander. I guess that's still the big mystery. But just real quickly, there's been a couple of unusual sightings in Wisconsin for 2024. And if we just look back, there was a bird called the field fare, which is a European thrush that showed up. That was back in February. It was in Ashland. And then later on, a bird of prey from way down south, the crested caracara, very common from Florida to Texas. You'll start to see them in all throughout Central South America. So we're a little bit of distance away from there. Then in December, early December, in Sturgeon Bay, there was a sage thrasher, which is a bird out of the southwest. And now in somewhat the same location, white wagtail, which is really from Asia. And these birds, of course, do migrate in those continents. And occasionally something will cross over, say like the field fare coming from Europe showing up here. Or Asian birds, which is a little less common because the Pacific is a much bigger barrier to cross over. What he's doing here, how he got that far off course, it's really hard to say. And is it becoming more common or not? I don't know. Are human impacts, environmental changes disrupting some of the bird movement? We don't really have a good history, but I've always thought about it in the past. It seemed to me that the rarest bird sightings in Wisconsin always showed up in the backyards of the best bird watchers in the state. And the reason for that, of course, is because they knew what they were looking at. And yeah. I'm sure over the years, there are a lot of people that look out their window or walk in a park and go, I just saw something that just didn't look and he's not in my book. And it ends there. What we have today, of course, with the internet capabilities to both use Merlin on your phone to search or to find an expert somewhere to get a picture and to be able to share that, these words are getting out really fast. When I first started bird watching Wisconsin, the State Ornithological Society had a rare bird hotline. Well, that was telephone, which meant that somebody would find something somewhere in the state, come back home, remember to call up, leave a message on that, and then you would have to listen in usually before the weekend if you wanted to go out and look for something. And by that time, the bird was probably gone. I mean, nowadays, I've had instances here where people have actually found the bird. I'm on it, talking to my friend on the cell phone. He's driving. He's a half hour away. I just posted it on the internet with pictures, and the word gets out. And so I think...
Lickety split.
Yeah, and we're starting to find the ability of this communication to go on. And certainly the bird watchers always have had some sort of a network. It's certainly more efficient these days. But also the non-birders, the people who are just looking in their backyard and say, I need to get in touch with someone. And that was the case with the sage thrasher, for example. And from what I understand, I was out of the country, but I was following the emails a bit about that bird. The homeowners were incredibly gracious, allowing the bird watchers to come. And then after a week or so, they had to ask people to watch from the road and step back a little bit. It was just such an unusual sighting. Everybody wanted a view. And so, yeah, I mean, it's one thing to invite people over to share an experience. It's another thing to have half the bird watchers in the state wanting to clamber around your backyard. But, you know, the word gets out so quickly to people these days. And so maybe that's also a bias, just that if there is something that shows up, we've got two things. There's a huge cadre of bird watchers who are really out there looking for things. And somebody usually knows someone to call if there's something shows up that they're not familiar with, and that word spreads so fast. So, you know, we also have that kind of speed of communication today.
That helps or maybe hinders if you're the homeowner. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, let's go to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Oops, I hung up.
No, you're there. I bet she was listening to...
Hello.
Hello.
Ruth, are you there?
Yes. Yes, I thought I hung up, but I didn't. I have turkeys here. We have a lot of turkeys, and they have discovered our flowering crab trees, and half of them will go up, 5-6 birds will go up in the tree and pick them out of the tree, and the rest of the birds will stay down below and pick up what they knock off.
That's quite a sight to see a 20-pound bird up there eating those berries, isn't it?
Yes, and the poor tree.
Well, and the poor cardinal or the robins that may want to come in for a late season meal. It's going to be picked clean here pretty quickly, I got to imagine.
Oh, man. Well, turkeys in the crab apple tree.
Yeah, enjoy it while they're there. And yep, so they give you quite a view and a chance for some nice photos.
Thanks, Ruth. Appreciate it. Jim in Hollandale, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm a retired dairy farmer, and I take good care of my dairy barn. And I've noticed over the years, we've had owned this farm for 44 years, and I've noticed over the years that the swallows come back to the same nests every year mm-hmm. and the same place every year. How do they keep track of all that?
That is one of the mysteries of how they're able to migrate that far and come back to the same location and even the same nest site. That's just one of the wonders of birds, of their ability to navigate. And swallows cover huge distances in a year because they're feeding on the wing. So when they migrate, it's not like a lot of our songbirds that pick up and are heading from point A to point B, make a few stops along the way to rest, refuel, and continue the journey. Swallows are just feeding and just swooshing around and just slowly drifting to the south and then coming back again. Some of these birds will go all the way down to Argentina, will just feed down there and turn around and just gobbling up insects along the way and then return. And as you mentioned, unerringly come back right to that same location. I know some people have a hard time finding their own way home some days. So how do these birds do that with that ability? We've learned more and more about birds, and with even the new technology and intensive studies, we've been able to discover things about birds that were never known before. But this ability to navigate is still a mystery. And so we do know a lot of the external stimuli that birds rely on for migration and orientation, but we still don't know how they process it. In other words, we know what they can be stimulated by and what they respond to, but we don't know how they think and how they put this all together and how they do some of the things they do. But I guess that's the mystery of nature, and it keeps it so fascinating.
Jim, thank you for calling. Donna in Eau Claire, on to you. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, in your Christmas bird count, what have you noticed the birds that are least counted, you know, that are fewer, and then some that are more? I just moved here from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, mm-hmm. and we always had certain numbers of birds that decrease depending on the weather, too, of course. So mm-hmm. I'll listen to your reply. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, thanks for asking.
So what are the bird counts showing?
Well, of course, as she indicated, there are those annual ups and downs and changes. As we talked earlier, the finches, there are some years where they really invade into Wisconsin in large numbers. Other years, we hardly record them. Snowy owls tend to come about every 4 years when the lemming population crashes in Canada. So some of these are either somewhat regular cycles or somewhat erratic cycles of birds. If you want to look at trends in populations, that's a matter of over time. So you want to start, take a look at, say, 10, 20, 30 years of data. And what we find is that, no doubt, with human impacts and uses of the environment, we change the land dramatically. And there are some birds that certainly do suffer from that. But what we find is that, on average, about a third of our birds are increasing, a third are remaining the same, and a third decreasing. And what it comes down to is, as we alter the land, there are winners and losers. So every time we change it, some of them actually benefit, which tend to be the generalists.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Those are the common birds that always get by. The specialists are the losers.
Bill Volkert, our guest, he'll be with us right through the show today. It's great to have him with us to answer your questions. And we were talking travel, but we haven't gotten into much travel yet because we've had so many good questions, which we always enjoy. And we'll be back with Bill right after this look at the news. You stay with us. We're getting a bird update today from our regular guest, Bill Volkert. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Bill, of course, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist, and a lot of experience. He's 4,400 bird species to his list. So he's moving toward the halfway to the 11,000 that are out there. And lots of questions and calls. Bill, I did want to bring up a bit about traveling and birding and travels. Any comments on that whole process?
Well, once you have explored and discovered the birds that we find here in your backyard around Wisconsin, or even starting to travel around the United States or into foreign countries, there's two ways to do it, either joining an organized tour or the independent travel. And each of these have their trade-offs and their benefits. If you join a tour, it's simple. It's already packaged, put together. Somebody knowledgeable has organized everything for you. You've got a guide who knows both the hot spots, how to get there, and knows the birds. Oftentimes, they'll pick up a local guide who's an expert for that particular property as well. And so you'll see more birds that way because you're with an expert the whole way. Independent travel, well, this has been my preferred way of doing it. And they're actually one of the reasons why I started traveling independently was at Horicon Marsh. I was always with people. I was always the tour leader. And as such, I was always the instructor, the teacher. By traveling independently, I don't have an expert to always tell me everything, so I have to study them a little bit more intensively. I became the student again and a chance to discover it. I will admit, I mean, I pick up a guide whenever I can, because I can find quite a few birds on my own in a country, but no, you need the local who's going to take you to the rarities and is knowledgeable. And then it's fun just to learn a one-on-one of somebody there that knows those birds, and it's great. I can travel a little bit longer, I say, for the same budget as you would. I may not find as many birds. The other problem of traveling independently is I always rent a car and do the driving. And trying to, first of all, find the place. I can't tell you how many countries I've been lost in.
Yeah.
So that's always a challenge. And I can see, I wish somebody would just get me there right away. And the problem on your own is just driving itself. I'm pretty used to it. I've done a lot of that. But it's right side driving, left side driving, and always what I call freestyle driving, where there are no rules or very few or nobody obeys them. So you'll commonly see in Central South America that type of driving where lines on the road are just advisory or suggestion. Yeah. Two lanes become five. I will admit that's probably one of the more challenging drives I've ever done is I actually drove a car for 1,000 miles in India. Even the locals couldn't believe that. They said, we don't drive in this country. But it gave me the independence because I can take a side trip. I can drive down some road. I can stop for a photo along the way. We can do it at our own pace. So, there's, again, a little bit of a trade-off of how you want to travel. But, one way or another, to get to those places and be able to see these birds, it's really quite an experience. And I would have to say good travel is habit forming. I know a lot of people who've never traveled. I've had some say, well, I'm not interested. I don't want to. I think part of it is they haven't discovered it, and there's a real apprehension to get out of your comfort zone and go somewhere completely different, distant, foreign, maybe even a different language. Yeah, it can be quite uncomfortable. That's why a group tour is really nice. But once you discover that and you've been there and you open your eyes to it and you've seen that richness of birds and landscapes, all it does is want you to see more. So, yeah, it becomes habit-forming.
Bill Volkert, our guest. You know, earlier in the show, we were talking about crows and ravens, and you were talking about the differences between crows and ravens, and the calls came up.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff and somebody else then emailed and said, hey, how about hearing the sounds of a craven versus of a raven versus a crow?
Mm-hmm.
Craven would be Scott Craven. Yeah. And he would sound quite a bit different. So let's hear. I think Jeff's got him up here.
Yes, please.
Let's hear. Just start with whatever you got and we'll identify it.
There's that raspiness of the raven.
Yeah.
It's a croak.
Yeah.
A little bit more of a throaty rattle call compared to that softer cawing that we hear out of the crow. And there's a lot of variation on that. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, this is a little bit of a harsher call of a crow. That's what we call the mobbing call. So when they find an owl, they're calling other crows in to get, you'll actually see them flying in. It's probably the best way to find an owl, too. If you find crows doing this type of a raspy, screeching call, and you see other crows coming in from a distance, there's an owl there. And it's the best way to find owls, actually.
Michael in Maple Bluff has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have a variety of feeders. We get quite a variety of birds, ground feeders, and hanging feeder types. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we have probably too many because we occasionally attract a hawk or an owl. But we have had a couple of times recently when for a period of 2 days, we would see no birds whatsoever. Now, we know that when a predator comes around, the birds all take cover and you don't see them. But this was, they didn't even come to feed. So we're trying not to be paranoid, but we're wondering, are there sonic devices or something that could affect all species simultaneously and keep them from their regular feeding habits?
Good question. Probably not for home use. They have experimented with some of this on airports because obviously bird strikes are a big problem. And when planes are taking off or coming down, that's the elevation that birds are flying at. So bird strikes are certainly a concern for airline safety. Some of them have tried different kinds of calls and things. Some of it is even playing the stress calls of some of the birds to try to keep them away. A few of the airports will actually employ falconers and will bring people out there to chase off those birds. So, yeah, they use multiple things, but I think you always have to change it. You know, the problem if playing a recording is they'll habituate. So you have to watch a little bit there, too, that the birds just get used to. It's like, nothing to worry about. For myself, I know when I do pishing, to lure the birds in, if you just get here, especially chickadees and little warblers out there, if you just do a simple little psh, 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 it gets their attention. They jump up, and sometimes they'll actually come right in. What I notice is, they're curious. They hear the sound. They come in. But once they realize it's just me, you can't bring them in a second time. So, again, they realize it's nothing worthwhile their time. So that habituation is a problem. I don't know if there's anything.
I'm thinking a raptor maybe.
Yeah, now it's going to get back to that. I think what you've got is a hawk in the area, and it's not uncommon. And, well, there's two ways to look at it. One, you feel like you're setting up your birds because you're bringing them into feeder. You're making them easy pickings and targets, and then the hawk comes by and picks off a cardinal right off your feeder. On one way, you can look at it, well, the hawk has to eat too. On the other hand, you're also making it pretty darn easy for them. And the most common one would be Cooper's hawk. In fact, on my way over here to the studio today, I had one fly right in front of my vehicle, and he was going through a residential area. I'm sure he was going from one feeder to the next looking for some easy food. If you do have a hawk that's starting to hunt your feeder, just shut it down for about 10 days, 2 weeks. Let the birds disperse, And it looks like in this case, they did on their own because they realize it's too dangerous to try to come in for food. And as I said earlier, most of their food is gotten from the wild anyhow. They're not going to starve. Just shut it down. Let them disperse. Let that hawk move on as his luck goes down. And then you can start up again. But yeah, it sounds like you had a predator that was out there and the birds were just frightened to come in for food.
Michael, thank you for calling. Tim in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Just a comment before my question. My wife and I went on a birding trip to the Galapagos Islands back in July. It was just spectacular. The birding there was just stunning.
Good for you. Yeah, very nice.
Yeah. So anyway, we have a couple platform feeders. I put a bunch of peanuts on there. And the blue jays come in and they eat those peanuts, and you can just count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then they'll fly away. And then 5 minutes later, they're back, and they eat another 5 or 6 peanuts.
Yep.
Are they storing these peanuts someplace? They just can't possibly eat this many peanuts.
They may actually be caching some of them. And the other thing you're doing is you're giving them top shelf food. Their peanuts is, first of all, it's out of the shell. It's easy to get at, and they're gobbling up as fast as they can. I guess it's almost like, say, having a room full of kids and putting out a bunch of pizzas compared to putting out a bunch of, say, celery sticks. So, they're really taking the top shelf food for them. So, but yeah, it sounds like they're caching. You'll see nuthatches do this too. They'll come by, grab a sunflower seed one at a time, and they'll wedge it into the bark. Sometimes in order to peck on it, sometimes they're storing. It's like, well, guys, don't work so hard. I got a whole feeder full, and I'll fill it tomorrow again. But those are just their instincts to be able to grab a little extra food just in case it runs out.
Tim, thank you for calling. Glenn and Spooner, on to you. Hi, Glenn.
Hi. You know, earlier I heard you talking about the playfulness of ravens.
Yeah.
This first time I saw this up close and personal, my neighbor was outside working on a project, and he'd been doing it for several days. He said, you know, you're just about in time for the show. I said, what show are you talking about? He's not going to believe this. I've got a raven that likes to show off in front of me flying upside down. And it wasn't 2 minutes later. This raven, I could tell the call, you know, and he made a call, and then he came not too much above us, and he went back and forth 5 or 6 times. My friend said, yeah, he does that every day.
That's a great story. I've heard of that before, and yeah, it seems as if the ravens not only have that excess time, but they make use of it. And it's sort of an exception to the bird world that there is that playfulness in them. I mean, all birds, it must be exciting to be able to fly, but that's out of necessity. Ravens seem to kind of revel in it. They're just because they can. So, yeah, great observation. Wonderful story.
Thanks, Glenn. Appreciate that call and that story. Nathan in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Nathan.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, Larry. How are you folks doing today?
Great.
Fantastic.
Good. Hey, I used to work for the National Wildlife Health Center.
Oh, good.
And my wife still works there. She's a veterinarian epidemiologist there. So our neighbors know that we can be relied on for some disease questions and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a call yesterday that there was a snowy owl down on the ground by New Glarus Woods.
Hmm.
And so we figured, well, that's just normal for them because they're a tundra bird.
Right.
But we decided to run out there and take a look anyways. Turns out she was a young female snowy owl. But we hadn't heard of any eruptions. And so we never have heard of a snowy owl this far south. It's rare even in eruptions, but not having them here without an eruption. And so I was wondering if you had any insight on this behavior.
What I've heard about is that it's only more recently snowy owls are starting to show up in Wisconsin, so they seem to be a little bit later, not in huge numbers. It's not a big eruption year, but we always get a few. And it's not uncommon that a lot of them are the young ones that head out. And on the ground, as you said, yes, that's where they normally will roost and hunt from because they're used to being in areas without trees. But what also happens is a lot of these are young, inexperienced birds, and these have been long flights for them, and they're oftentimes in very poor shape. And I know ones that have been brought into the rehabilitation centers, it's starvation. So if the bird is looking rather listless, it may be just that he's just not hunting that well. Being young and inexperienced and have just flown 1,000 miles to get here, it can be extremely rough on them.
Yeah. And we did a show on snowy owls not that long ago with a DNR guy who keeps track of the snowies in the state. At that moment, I think there were 28 that had been noticed in the state this year.
And as we said earlier, with so many bird watchers out there, we're getting a pretty good count because it's very much a sought-after bird for people to want to see, and people are going to desired spots for them and really looking for them, too.
But, December 4th was the Snowy Owl Show, I'm being reminded of, and this is perfect time to remind you, if you miss a show or part of a show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives. And if you go to WPR.org/Larry, and then you can scroll through and find the appropriate date. In this case, for the Snowy Owl Show, that was December 4th. So WPR.org/Larry, and you can hear any of those previous recordings, including this one about 2 o'clock each day. We post the show from the day. So just like an hour after it's over, we're posting it. So that's cool. Nathan, again, thank you. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi there. Yeah, I just like Bill's comments on the disgusting practice of lawn care services, putting those poisons into the environment, especially in the residential areas where we have our robins. I'm wondering how many robins are being poisoned, not only robins, but any birds. And then one more comment to the listeners. Don't let your cats run loose. They take so many birds every year.
Yeah, those Thank are some you. Really good hints, you bet. As far as, say, the contaminants in the environment, how does that affect birds? It certainly can't be good for them. They're certainly exposed one way or another that they're either feeding in areas or maybe even their food itself is accumulating some of those chemicals. And, of course, there's always a question, you know, what is the level of risk? Just because there's a certain chemical out there, is it harmful or not, or at what level? The problem is really detecting now what the impact is because, of course, if a bird starts to succumb to it, it's going to find a place to hide and usually dies out of sight. And there was an interesting study done a number of years ago where they're taking a look at the ways of detecting those kinds of impacts on birds. And what the ornithologists were doing was driving around looking for roadkill birds and anybody who found a bird that, say, hit a window and just collecting bodies. And the idea was, okay, if somebody were to spray a chemical on an agricultural field or on a golf course or backyard, birds are exposed and they die. How long do those carcasses lay out there that we can go and survey and detect this? So they took all these bodies of birds, put them out in a countryside, laid them out in a field, and what they found was that more than 70% disappeared overnight. Oh. So the scavengers were out there picking them up right away, and within 3 days, everything was gone. So those mammals out there as scavengers, and we're talking about the raccoon, possum, skunks that are all out there looking for any easy meal, they're picking this stuff up as fast as possible, and during the day, the vultures come in. So in other words, if something were to die, you'd have to find where it had found a hiding place and get out there almost, you know, within, say, a couple of hours of it keeling over. And that is completely, you know, just so random and such a slight chance. So in other words, we have no way of really assessing this accurately. We really don't know. But I guess the assumption is it can't be good. It's certainly not helping them. And so you're right. Yeah, let's try to keep it as healthy of an environment as we can. It's better for the wildlife around us and certainly for ourselves.
Lee, thank you. Appreciate it. Claire in Baraboo will give you a chance. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Speaking of snowy owls, yesterday I was sitting in my car and my breath caught literally when I looked up and saw a very large white-chested bird perched in a tree. And I thought, my God, is that a snowy owl? And I looked twice, and its head was too tapered. And then it finally flew off, and I knew for sure that was not a snowy owl because it had a gray back.
Mm-hmm.
What could that be, a hawk or a falcon?
A red-tail hawk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, red tails, they have a very whitish breast, especially the older birds. And you know, the name red-tail, well, yes, the tail does have that very distinctive copper color. And as I used to teach people for bird identification, if that's your only clue, you're going to have to see it at the right angle. There's a lot of other hints that will help you identify that bird. And even driving down here, I saw two red-tails perched right off the roadside. Yes, big white chest. And that's certainly a very good clue for the bird, and that's no doubt what you had.
Yeah, thank you, Claire. Appreciate it. Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News, talking birds today with Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Always great to have him come by. And callers online and some emails. Let's go to the phones. Cheryl in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Cheryl.
Good afternoon. I've been listening with great interest to the program today. Thank you so much. My question is in regard to amounts of magnetite that might be in bird brains and whether the magnetite is used for navigation. Mm-hmm. Thank you, and I'll listen to the response.
Oh, good question. There was a very old study, kind of classical one, or I think it was back in at least the 1950s or even late 40s. And this was looking at that very thing, is do birds navigate by magnetic fields? And this was a captive little flock of homing pigeons. We know we can take them way out in the countryside. They fly around and find their way right back home, where the name came from. Well, they took the birds. These were from around the New York area, drove all the way down to Virginia. And before they released them, they took one sample group and they put a little brass plate on their head just to make sure that just having weight on your head was not the problem. The others got a magnet. Sure enough, the ones with the brass plate found their way back home, and the ones with the magnets were circling somewhere, and it seemed to interrupt with their navigation. So we do know that this is one of the environmental clues that at least some birds are sensitive to. And as we talked about earlier, 11,000 species of birds. A lot of them are not migratory, especially in tropical areas. Others do move around short distances or seasonally, and others undertake some very long migrations. And among that whole vast spectrum of migratory birds, do they all use that? Are some birds more sensitive to certain other environmental clues? We do know that some birds use stellar navigation. They migrate at night, so the stars are important. What happens when it's overcast? We do know that certainly pigeons are sensitive to magnetic fields, and we think that sandhill cranes or the whooping cranes certainly are. You know, whooping cranes, we've kept really good track of each individual because of the investment in there, and it is a highly endangered bird. And the ones that we've originally trained to go south by ultralight, they're now following others. Well, all we have to do is train them to go south. They find their own way back again. And we've had instances where some birds were just plain off course. There was one found in South Dakota, one in Michigan, and one in, I believe, was Connecticut. They got off course, but it's interesting as you plot where they are, it's at the same latitude as where the release site was. They knew how far north to go, but they seem to have to learn from the landscape how far east-west to get to where they are. So they seem to be using certain clues. Geographic features are certainly important. Birds migrate up and down the coasts along the Mississippi River, follow the Rocky and Appalachian Mountains. So those are very important right here in Wisconsin. No doubt the Lake Michigan shore is a very important north-south corridor for birds. So these are all multiple kinds of stimuli that birds rely on. But as I said earlier, how do they process it? Now, how do they think? And what are, say, the fallback of this if stellar navigation is important, but the clouds roll in? Winds are certainly going to be important. You want to go north, you want a south wind behind you, but it won't give you the direction. So we're learning more and more about bird migration and about their behavior than ever before. And with the advances of scientists, we're able to study things like not before. But this processing of birds, what are they thinking? Getting inside that little bird brain is still a mystery. And I think that's really kind of the joy of it. There's something we probably will never completely understand about it. It's just the marvel of nature. And it's just wonderful to see. And I think it's a little bit humbling that these birds are doing things that we just cannot explain completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's take another call. Betsy in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, Larry. It's good to talk with you after all these years. I live in the town of Dodgeville, so in the city, it's in quote, and have lived here over 50 years. And the other day,
I have a tamarack right outside my window that went up to the top of my two-story house. And I noticed a little before 10 o'clock, there was a northern harrier sitting in it, sleeping.
Oh, there's a great
view. It ended up being there until after 3 o'clock. And around 12, it woke up. And it would stretch its wings or, you know, and things. And I kept thinking, well, it must have had an early breakfast because I've never seen northern harriers in town. I've seen them outside of town, low over the prairie. So anyway, it eventually flew away, and I just felt very honored. But 2 days later on my small deck, not far from where that one was in the tamarack,
mm-hmm.
I have a camera, and there was the female, and she was banded. And so I have that on video.
Oh, wow.
And later that day, I saw her twice, right near that tree, right in the tree that kind of intermingles with it. And I thought, what were they doing in town? I do feed birds there. But, of course, no birds showed up while the harrier was sleeping in the tree.
Yeah.
It was exciting to me.
Oh, very exciting, and very lucky to be able to enjoy that. Harriers, of course, are feeding out over open fields and marshes. So they will course back and forth, and they as much listen for their prey, like owls do, as watching for anything. And it's a mid-size hawk, but it's got relatively small feet, so they're taking the smaller rodents. And probably one of the big ones are going to be the field mice, our little meadow voles. And like lemmings up in the Arctic, our rodents here also have 4 to 5 year cycles. And I wonder if we don't have a rodent high right now, that we have a peak, that there's a lot of available food that, first of all, is keeping them here in winter and attracting them. And sounds like they also are eating well, that they've got the time to roost, rest, digest their meal, so you're able to enjoy the bird. I remember years ago, we had just a absolute rodent peak around Horicon Marsh. And I had never seen so many hawks. And normally, hawks do not tolerate other birds hunting nearby. They need that big area, so they've got it all to themselves for any potential prey. I actually saw a 20-acre field with 9 hawks on it.
Oh.
There must have been so many rodents. They didn't care if somebody was sitting right next to them because there was so much food. And, you know, it's one thing to drive down a country road and see a little meadow vole or short-tail shrew run across the road. I was actually seeing 3 or 4 in a day, which doesn't sound like a lot, but the chance of, say, and even in 6 months to see one is a pretty rare sight. So there must have been something just off the charts. And so I think what you've got is you've got a real rodent peak right now in the population. There's a lot of food that's attracting those birds, and they're obviously feeding well.
Betsy, thank you so much. Appreciate your call.
Great observation.
Yes, indeed. Gary in Stevens Point has something different for us. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Doing Project Peter Watch here the other day, I noticed the crabapple tree, which got taken out in a windstorm. I left the trunk. It's 10 foot tall and, 10 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And the woodpeckers are excavating a really good hole in there. I'm wondering how tolerant will they be in summertime when you're out in the yard and they got little ones there.
The amount of disturbance around a nest site, right now, of course, they're just pecking there for feeding. They may excavate a cavity for a nest site. And oftentimes I've seen woodpeckers will excavate more than one. And then finally the female is the one who's going to choose one of those. I think that's an awful lot of work to go through. But, they're looking for a place where they can safely raise their young and feel somewhat secluded. And so, they may start early in the season when there's not a lot of traffic, and they may end up moving somewhere else if they think that it's just not quite as safe, as secure, or private as they had expected it to be. So that's just a matter of, just chance to see how tolerant the birds are. And it seems just some individuals seem to tolerate disturbance and proximity a little more than others do. So, just watch and see what happens. But right now, they're just simply excavating for food.
Gary, thank you so much for calling. Mike and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. My question is about migration here in southern Wisconsin. I've noticed large groups of Canadian geese, just Canadians, flying north already, headed towards Horicon, leaving the Wisconsin and Mississippi River valleys. I also noticed a flock of about 300 seagulls headed north, and I had a very rare sighting, a robin, at my bird feeder this morning and at the bird bath, and I have never seen a robin this early in the year ever. Is this a common occurrence now? Are the birds changing their migration times due to global warming? And I'll take my answer up there.
Good questions. We talked about this earlier. There are some robins that'll stick around through the winter. So this is not, say, an early migrant. It's somebody who just never left in the first place. So that very small percentage of birds that decide to stay around and tough it out in a Wisconsin winter, that's one of those. And you just happen to find your backyard as a place to stop over. As far as the Canada geese and gulls that are moving around, two things. First of all, are they actually migrating north, or are they just simply flying north from a roost area to a feeding site? And, you know, I used to get this question at Horicon, and say in fall time, people like, you know, it's fall, they should all be going south. And this morning I drove around the marsh, and there were thousands, they're all flying north. Well, they're just simply going out to feed. And the way to tell the difference is by how high they're flying. When geese are going from a resting site out to feed, usually they'll fly 1 to 500 feet up. So the farther they fly, they'll gain a little more altitude. When they're in true migration, they'll be up 2 to 5,000 feet. And we've actually recorded Canada geese over 10,000 feet. So they're going to be up much higher in a true migration. So this sounds like this time of year, probably more local movement. But Canada geese, they will move around where there's food, and our snow melted all of a sudden in southern Wisconsin. So all of that food that's out there, the waste grain and stuff they can go for, it's now available. So, yeah, very likely they just move north a little bit, probably shorter distances. Maybe we could call it a migration if they came up from Illinois to feed here. But, yeah, it looks like all of a sudden food became available. And same thing with gulls, as quite the generalists and feeders. They're taking advantage of this little break in the weather.
Rich in St. Germain has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Very interesting show. I'm enjoying it.
Thank you very much.
But I was wondering, you're talking about birds migrating and how they know where to go. But I was thinking one step before that, that maybe it's in the DNA, because you could have an egg and hatch it, and that little bird is going to know his song and know how to build a nest without seeing mother, I think. I believe, you know.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I think that's the same with people. We have a little bit of that. You always hear a little kid would know how to play the violin, and they're like, oh, great-great-grandfather played the violin, you know. So maybe there's something to the DNA, and...
Yeah.
Well, you're onto something there. Like, yep.
Yeah.
You know, we refer to this generally as instinct. And, yeah, you're right, that birds, as far as the migration, some of them can seem to do this entirely without any learning. And again, as I mentioned earlier, different birds seem to be cluing in on different types of environmental cues out there. We know for sandpipers, for example, they're nesting up in the Arctic. The parents take off before all the young. They move independently, and somehow they know where to go. And it seems to be an inherited knowledge and information. Somehow they're born with that. Yeah, nest building, that's pretty automatic. Sure, there's experience with that. The more they do it, they get better at it. They will build them faster, and they'll find better places for securely raising a family. So we know the older birds are usually more successful in raising a family because they've done it before. As far as song, by the way, that's something that they are born with, that ability to make the voice, but there is learning. And so we've actually done this where we've taken eggs out of the nest so even the developing embryo doesn't hear the adult, raise it in a laboratory, and it has the voice, but it doesn't make the full song. That's why we actually find there are dialects of birds across the country, because some learn a little bit of a different language, so to speak, or a different accent of the song than birds somewhere else. But when it comes down to instinct, there is this a unique behavior that birds seem to be born with inherently to do things. And yet somehow I think as a scientist, we would say, well, instinct is not only things that birds do automatically, but that we can't explain. They just do it. So we just sort of write it off as instinctive, because we really have no way of knowing How is it that they're born with that ability or that information, that knowledge? It's just what they do, and we have no idea how that's passed on or in what part. And you can just say it's in the DNA, which again is about as descriptive as saying it's instinctive or it's inherited knowledge. It just means that really they do it automatically, and I couldn't tell you.
Deb emailed us, how in the world do little birds keep from freezing, especially their little feet?
Well, yeah, you watch ducks that are standing on the ice and walking out there. You sure wouldn't take your shoes off and walk around in this weather. But first of all, birds are developed quite differently from us. Take a look at their feet. It's really just tendons and scale. So it's not muscle like we have. And it's just really all they have to do is to be able to flex that leg to move around or hop. And, of course, to move the toes to be able to perch and cling to something. So they, first of all, don't have that real heavy tissue. There's not a need for a major vascular system. They, of course, can't let it freeze. But the body temperature is much warmer than the temperature in their feet. If it was, say, a duck that's sitting out on open water where that water is at, say, 35 degrees, that would be sucking the heat right out of their body. So they chill the feet down, they close off that vascular system, and then they have a counter current flow system. The vessels are right next to each other. So as the blood is going out of the body, it's being cooled, so they're not losing the heat, and then it's coming back up again and warming within the system. So yeah, they're superiorly adapted to be able to survive out there at those temperatures that for us, I mean, you can hardly take your gloves off for 5 minutes without suffering a frostbite. But that's, again, the wonderful adaptations that birds have to these harsh environments.
Alan Hillsborough wonders, how to attract barn swallows without building a barn?
Well, I don't think you have to build an entire barn, but I've suggested to this to groups where, first of all, you need a little bit of a tradition or an opportunity where you have the barn swallows in the neighborhood because, as a caller mentioned earlier, they're coming right back to the same place. So it's tough to attract a new group, but if you've got them somewhere nearby, you might be able to get some of those neighbors and bring them in. And what I would suggest is if you've got them nearby, we talked earlier as well about these steel buildings, there's just no place to put a nest.
Yeah.
I think if you were to do a long shelf under the eaves, you would then have that sort of attractive structure. It's sheltered from the weather. It's a place to perch a nest because these are little globs of mud they're using and fiber in there. So they need a place to be able to adhere that nest to and to be sheltered. So I think we could actually structure it that way. And of course, the problem is that for construction, it's not important, but we could add it to it very easy for the sake of the birds.
Terry emailed, he has 5 turkeys in the backyard in Wauwatosa feeding on sunflower seeds under 4 feeders. The squirrels have claimed the territory as their own, so the interplay between the turkeys and the squirrels is entertaining. And Terry has a new respect for squirrels. They do not back down, and they are tough.
Especially for a turkey that's 20 times his size. They get quite aggressive over the food. And, you know, it's interesting that right in town like that he's got the turkeys. That has been a success story. Yeah. The turkeys have done so well. You know, the original range for turkeys in historic times was from roughly La Crosse, Green Bay area, that southern part of the state, southern third, so to speak, is where we found them. Now they're all the way up to the Lake Superior shore. I think the only place we don't have turkeys or very low numbers would be the far northeast in that real heavy woods. It's just not the kind of food available. So they have reclaimed Wisconsin and expanded to areas way beyond where they originally were. And I remember when we first wanted to bring turkeys to the Northern Kettle Moraine, we were successful in getting the first couple established in the Driftless area in Crawford and Vernon County. And we had nobody with turkey experience in Wisconsin because we hadn't had turkeys for 100 years. So we brought a biologist from Tennessee. We had him come up and travel around. And I remember him telling us, he says, you know, we've got a rule of thumb. If you have 10,000 contiguous acres of mixed oak forest, you'll have turkeys. So we captured some turkeys from Crawford County, brought them to Kettle Moraine, and they've done well. I've seen them not in 10,000 acres, but 10-acre woodlots. Yeah. They've done better than even the experts would have predicted. So, yeah, what a comeback. It's amazing. And they're right in town in people's backyards eating their crab apples and everything else.
Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking birds today on the program with Bill Volkert, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Mike in Algoma has a comment for us about barn swallows, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I moved in outside of Algoma about 50 years ago, old barn, and there were probably dozens of barn swallows in the basement. And that went along for quite a few years until maybe the last 10 or 15, where they started to drop off. There weren't nearly as many families coming back. And the reason for that, as I can understand it, is that there's no longer agricultural activity going on in the near area that there used to be before. So they need the mud in order to build a nest. And with fields in alfalfa, with very little turnover, I'm thinking that that's the reason why they're gone.
Well, yeah, you're right that they do need something for the nest construction. I think after any rainstorm, they usually can find a puddle somewhere. I've seen them picking mud from there. Probably the bigger impact is just the tremendous decline in insects, that there just isn't that food out there. And they are somewhat colonial. I mean, you've got a good barn, you can have a not just a single nest, but you've got a whole series of them there. And what happens for these colonial nesting birds is it's very hard to attract them to a new site. So you could build a barn or a structure right now, but you have to have them somewhere in the neighborhood to track them from and get the first few to actually use it and start a tradition. The problem is they're also very easy to lose. And as the populations begin to decline, once you've lost the last ones, there's that complete break in tradition. And so since they're going back to the very same place, if you lose your colony, it's not easy to bring a new colony back again. And so as I've watched birds, I've studied great blue herons and egrets, and we've watched our purple martins, same thing. Easy to lose a colony, but very hard to start a new one. And that seems to be kind of a rule of thumb about these colonial nesting birds.
Let's take another call. Stuart in Token Creek, your turn. Hi, Stuart.
Good afternoon. Two things here quick. One's about a red-tailed hawk. I was in my kitchen last week and just happened to turn around towards my backyard. And I just, right as I turned around, a red-tailed hawk just did a 180 and got a squirrel in my yard.
Really? That is a kind of a rare thing because squirrels are fast and wary, and they'll get up those trees and around the backside where goshawks can hunt them. I've read about goshawks hunting cooperatively where one will actually perch, scare the squirrel to hide around the backside of the tree, and all of a sudden the mate comes in and snatches them. But redtail, this is a bird that tends to be not real maneuverable for a bird like that. So they tend to pounce on things. So small rodents, you know, the mice and rabbits. Squirrels are pretty wary and pretty darn fast. That is not a common prey item for them.
No.
Oh, good sight.
Good sight, Stuart. Yeah, thanks for calling. On the other hand, turning it around, we've had some information recently on research on squirrels eating birds or eating, you know, other animals as actual meat eaters. Well,
yes, they'll take nestlings.
I mean, this is something we've been hearing reports on for years on this program, and I didn't think it was any revelation at all, to be perfectly honest.
I thought it was pretty common knowledge that they are somewhat, as you say, meat eater, that they will take especially nestlings. Yeah. And in some areas can have a bit of an impact on local nesting birds. It's that short time when the nestlings are just out of the egg and still quite vulnerable.
But I've had people tell me that they were, and on the show, that birds that happen to be feeding on the ground around their feeders, and the squirrels are there too, and noticing a squirrel will suddenly jump and grab one of the birds.
I guess if there's an opportunity,
they'll take it.
But we also have interesting instances. This was in Wisconsin. They did a study on white-tailed deer and even had cameras on them just to see what their behavior was. And it had never been noticed before. It's basically like a GoPro on a deer. And they saw it reaching right in and grabbing a bunch of nestlings of songbirds out. And it's like, we never knew deer would do that. And so I don't think it happens with any frequency. But again, you know, if there's an opportunity,
they'll
round
take
out their diet. Yeah.
Tim in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi. I know earlier in the show, Bill, you were talking about Cooper's hawks, and I'm really interested in that because from what you said, I'm pretty certain that's what we have, that, you know, very opportunistic, comes through our backyard, you know, preys on the birds and then is gone and, you know, comes back. And I've not been able to identify if that's what this is. It certainly seems like an accipiter. But in terms of, you know, its plumage, its color, its behavior, is it very likely that that's what it is, or any other species that, you know, I could be looking for there?
It's probably the most likely. Now, for those people who are not that familiar with hawks, we divide them in two groups, which are the accipiters and the buteos. So red-tailed hawk is a buteo, and these are large, heavy birds, heavy-chested, big rounded wings, and large tails. Their habit of hunting is to perch or to soar and circle, and then to come down and pounce on their prey. Where the accipiters, which includes the little sharpshin, the coopers, the goshawk, they're built with short wings, long tails for ruddering and searing, and they run down their prey. I remember years ago talking to somebody and trying to describe the difference, and he just told me, well, it's kind of like the difference between fighters and bombers. And, yeah, you've got something that is a big, heavy wing load for a red tail. And like I say, it's very unusual for him to be that maneuverable to grab a squirrel. Where Cooper's hawks, they will run down their prey, and they can just kind of twist and turn and weave through the trees. The hard thing is between sharpshin and Cooper's, females are larger than males in those in all the hawks. And so a large sharpshin, which is a smaller cousin, can be as big as a small male Cooper's hawk. Mm-hmm. So there's a little oversize. You can't strictly go by size. But if you see, say, a small male sharpshin, barely the size of a blue jay, compared to a Cooper's hawk that will be well over 12, 14 inches, if they're on the extreme, size alone is pretty easy. The other problem is there's a difference between the immature and adult plumage. So the young ones of both of those are brown and very heavily speckled and streaked type of breast, where the adult, they've got this slate gray back and a real fine copper barring on the breast. So there's real variable in plumage. And the fact that they're usually hunting, it's a quick view. You see something shoot through and you've got a split second to try to identify it. They're some of the harder birds to learn. But Cooper's hawk is very common these days in Wisconsin, and is for a mid-sized hawk, one of the more common ones you'll see hunting from bird feeders and out in the countryside. So as you mentioned, one of the accipiters, it's one of the more common ones, but can't be confused with its smaller cousin, the sharpshin.
Tim, thank you so much for calling. Mary emailed us, going back to 2023 summer with Canada wildfires throughout the summer, you know, tremendous fires. Since we know that so many bird species breed in Canada forests, mm-hmm. do we know yet what the effect of those wildfires have had on bird populations?
Well, no doubt as you diminish the amount of acreage of available habitats, it's going to diminish the population, at least in terms of its nesting opportunity. It's not that birds are going to die, but a lot of them are going to not be having an area available to raise a family the following year. So no actual assessment of it, but it certainly is reducing the amount of nesting habitat. And you know, one of the misunderstandings is commonly, well, if we either develop an area or if we have a fire or something happens, the birds will just go somewhere else. Yes, they have to abandon it, and they'll fly out ahead of that fire. But somewhere else is already taken by that species, and it's filled to capacity. You cannot put more birds into it. So in other words, as we lose habitat, there's a net loss of birds.
Guy emailed us in 2023 in August, a storm with heavy rain caused a beaver dam in the Skiskobit River to fail, draining a 6-acre pond near their home. The next morning, birds began showing up to feast on the fish trapped in pools and laying dead. As the days passed, more and more eagles showed up for the feast. One morning, Guy counted 14 eagles around the pond, as well as ravens, gulls, kingfishers, and even owls.
Wow.
And this went on for more than a week. And this might explain what the earlier caller saw.
Yeah, something like that. That's an amazing spectacle. And to, you know, it's something that certainly doesn't happen very often. But to be able to observe that is really quite an unusual event. And yeah, it sounds like the you know, the food was just everywhere, and they all came in for that easy pickings for as long as it lasted. I've seen something very similar with, say, in some other countries, in the rice paddies, when they drain those. All of a sudden, all the fish and frogs become available. And in my most recent travel, actually, we made a stop intentionally because it was at the end of the rice season. And the egrets in there were just shoulder to shoulder because all that food was just getting stranded. And it's the same thing. It's easy pickings for them.
Well, I tell you what, here we are out of time, and we never got into your trips. So next time you're out, we're going to have to talk some more about some of those trips that you've just been on, and we'll get to hear some of those bird songs that you had up too. Bill, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Larry, and thank you, everyone.
Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, our guest. Always great to have him with us. And you've been a great audience today, as always. Thank you so much for listening. And a big thanks to Jeff Robbins, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnod. Who am I missing? Lee Rayburn and Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.